I was thinking about McLuhan. And okay, so I've been reading Eric McLuhan's book, Cynic Satire.
Oh yeah.
I sent
away okay.
That one. His book on Manippean satire, and basically the thing that he is adding, I summarized this before, I think, but the thing that he's adding to it is, to the history of scholarship on Manippean satire, is that it's the cynic tradition, and specifically the idea that it attacks the audience and has to upset the audience's sensibility. That's an essential aspect. Like if everyone's gonna come up with their list of essential attributes of a Manippean satire, Eric is basically saying like, well, and the most essential one that's missing is that it has to be addressed to the reader and hostile to the reader.
Go ahead. Hey Brian. When you get a chance to talk to Andrew McLuhan next, ask him if you can – how you get Eric's Ph.D. You used to have to get him to sign something you send to the Ann Arbor, Michigan Ph.D. place, warehouse. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe Michael or Andrew has the permission now, you know. Maybe – don't know if Eric organized it, but you want to read that book. It's better than the University of Toronto version. Because he has many pages on the history of Manippean satire, and it's really important because he goes through all the traditional definitions of Manippean satire. And the main one, if you quote an average educated English study or someone who's heard about Manippean satire, they'll look it up or they know that it is tends to be a philosophical discussion that ends up making fun of the philosophers trying to explain stuff. So it satirizes the intellectual act, and that's what it's always sort of been categorized as if you look up in the definitions. Right. But when you read traditional Manippean satires like Rabelais and those guys, and Swift, and even Finnegan's Wake, you say, well, there's more here going on than satire on philosophers, unless, you know, they're just overdoing, misspelling words, making crazy statements, that could be seen as needlessly bugging people. But what Eric came up with, which I guess he got from his father, is that Manippean satire changes every 400 years about when new technology comes in. This is over the last 2,000 years. And the new technology creates a new sensibility which needs to be satirized. You know, your sensibility that the media puts you into, the new media. So Manippean satire changes. It's not, it doesn't go by one constant description, all the way through history.
Yeah.
So, it changes. And, if you understand that it's basically going after what you're saying, going after the audience, the reader, satirizing them being entertained, basically, allowing themselves to be entertained, it's like too passive, That idea, I think, comes from the McLuhans. I don't think anybody else ever came up with that. But it explains the differences in Manippean satire. That in an information overload society, beginning of the 20th century, you satirize it by satirizing the reader who's stuck in this information overload. So that's what Finnegan's Wake is. It says, okay, you want information overload? I'll give you information overload. So, but that wouldn't have worked 400 years before. There was no information overload like that, right? So Rabelais did his thing, which had more content abuses. And that's the main thesis.
And could have seemed just as much of an overload to the sensibility of the time.
Yeah, people could say that, but not really. People, they enjoyed reading, and then the Manippean satire of that is Alexander Pope's The Dunciad. I think it's the last thing he did, and he did several versions of it, but he's basically saying this print revolution, and this is in 1742, so for 200 years we've had books, and it has turned out bad. Everybody's become stupid because they read stupid books. and they are too addicted to the book experience. So it's not really information overload. They're just addicted to reading books and bestseller kind of crap. That's where he attacks the audience. That's the theme. But that's a bit of a theme there, that he's not necessarily attacking the reader sensibility. It wasn't until Joyce's time that you could say, well, yeah, we're different from the literate people, the Goomer galaxy. There's a different sensibility. So we're going to go after the sensibility, not any ideas. So that's why McLuhan called it percepts. Mm-hmm. So Menippean satire, the cantos, are satire on the perceptual situation the humanity got itself into with the electric age. That's different from... it's slightly the same in the printing press with the Dunciad, where they're making fun of he's making fun of people who got dulled by books. But the electric media is a different situation because it actually excites people, and they have mob rule, and they go to war a lot, and they form gangs and attack other gangs, all within the city life, the strict limited urban life. So it's a different situation. Yeah.
And then you can still, you can still dull yourself with that, but it's a different, it has a different dulling effect
different
and requires a different kind of a satire to bring it out.
Right. So, so if you know that, what I just said, if you know that, you see where Eric said, Eric and McLuhan were different, and, Bakhtin and these guys, Julia Kristeva, they wrote about Menippean satire, but they get nowhere near what the McLuhans did.
Yeah.
But the McLuhans thing works because the way the electric media has gone in the digital age, it's made everybody a kind of a Menippean or a troll. Just someone, which they say social media made everybody lose their friends and everybody get oversensitive to everything or something. That situation is happening because everybody got a superiority complex because co-anesthesia put them in the driver's seat in Web 2.0. So that's what we got today. It's like beyond culture war. That would be the TV level. That'd be the TV body. But it's individual warfare now. It's metaphysical entities yelling at each other.
Yes. And... people feel, if people are trying to express a profound idea or something that's, you know, whatever, profound, whether it just affects them profoundly, they tend to reach for like multiple media and create some kind of a clash of them.
Yeah.
Just in the most basic way of mixing styles, that you instinctively reach for some unexpected juxtaposition. Like it has become more and more clear over the years that that's, you know, a kind of a basic aspect of art in the sense of not, I don't know, trying to create that shock to perceive something new.
Yeah, now McLuhan defined that. Back in the 60s, he said that art has to be done in the collage mode today if you're going to be a conventional artist. You have to do collage, which is what I get from what you're describing. That became a cliche, the collage.
And yes, and it's really making me see as well that a lot of the things that people will point to as being good literature or an interesting theory or something, has major aspects of Menippean satire, and that there's a kind of a, most of what goes on and is considered good art is satire of one kind or another. And,
yeah, some kind
and
of irony.
It's kind of more or less Menippean. And people
irony.
Really, it's just that people don't exactly know the difference.
It's the irony.
Sure.
That's what took over.
I mean, like you were the idea of being, dulled by the electric environment too. Like I certainly wouldn't call Bret Easton Ellis a Menippean satirist, but, he certainly satirizes something about the when people dull themselves out with electric with electric or post-electric sensibility, and he does a good job. I'm just thinking that his new novel is sitting here. I got it from the library, but I'm not ready to start it yet. But I wouldn't call him a Manipian, or I wouldn't call that a Manipian satire. The other book I'm looking at that I'm currently reading is Thomas Pynchon's Mason and Dixon, which I'm not sure I would totally call it a Manipian satire either, but it has more elements of that. Then yeah. It's like closer on the spectrum over to Manipian or not. But just things like people love this book, Infinite Jest, and that has a strong Manipian aspect. It's got like this double plot, and it's famous for its digressions, the footnotes, which are sometimes long and, anything plot happens.
Okay, so here's what's interesting.
That's a very big note. But people don't know what kind of device that is. They think it's more innovative than it really is. It's more traditional. It's a traditional thing to do.
So listen to this, Brian. So McLuhan started writing in 1950. He said, Orwell's a duffer. It's a quote in my Fatty Communion book. And he said, this present situation cannot be satirized. Yeah. See, so that's really important. What did he come up with? He said he did Manipian satire, and he wants to find it as a satire on the manners of the day. What are manners? Well, one time on a Monday, this woman came in. She was a local social gadfly, and she was doing an update of the famous manners book, whoever it was, famous book everybody used. So she was doing an upset, and McLuhan says, well, that's what I do. And nobody said anything to that. They didn't know what McLuhan meant. What, you do superficial manners, how to make a dining room table or something. So, but then you go back around the same time, he wrote to this obscure professor that I satirized the manners of society. So what are the manners? And I think me and Cameron are getting close to trying to define what it is McLuhan was doing. Language, literate, even comedy, oral comedy, does not work. So what McLuhan did, he put on altering society so drastically that he said, let me take over at the United Nations and I'll monitor the world with a computer and massage people with different technologies as their sensibilities get dulled. And he lays this out in Playboy. Okay, we're going to Venezuela gets a little hopped up too much from radio, so we turn off the radio and then the newspaper will calm them down and that kind of talk. That is, I think that's what his satire was.
He's kind of satirizing the, like, Rand Corporation or whatever, you know?
Yeah, he's satirizing the CIA, the Tetrad managers, which is what I want to play to illustrate this. Just a short thing, the Adam Vaughn recording. Let's see, where do I have it? You know, he's brought on TV to discuss Trudeau's cabinet changes.
Bob, that is available. The Adam Vaughn material is available on list 3. It's fourth up from the bottom.
Okay.
That was uploaded by me for video audio clarity purposes.
Yeah, you said you were going to try do something. So
I did. It's there.
Okay, so I'm looking at list 3.
Yeah, go to the very bottom.
Yeah.
Fourth one up.
Oh, okay. I was looking at the bottom 3. Well, it says Grimes. Oh, no, it's the sixth one up.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay, hold on. Yeah, I guess I put some other. No, is it? Yeah, okay. Well, on my list, I guess I haven't refreshed my list. Yeah, okay. So it's there.
All right. So I'm going to play about 2 or 3 minutes, the introduction statement by Adam.
Now, Bob, you know you have control over that. There's a pause button on that thing, right? So if you want to stop and comment, you can.
Right. So to finish that, so let's try to figure out how does one do Manipian satire today where individual chemical body expression doesn't work? It's not big enough. You know what I mean? It's you can't do, you can't, you will be absorbed, by the corporations. So by the 90s, that guy, somebody, Frank, wrote a book saying all alternative culture was absorbed by the corporations. You know, that theme, right? That if you, it actually, the more independent, rebellious it were in some way, anti-establishment, then you got better sales, and the corporations like that. You know that theme?
Hmm. No.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'll have to look up that book if you don't know it. So that's the point, is that would be the Android meme. Absorbed all resistance. So what is the tech body? So anyways, here, let's go back to Adam. So here we go.
Okay, well, coming up at 10:30 this morning, we are expecting what will be a sizable cabinet shuffle by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. So joining us in studio to talk more about this is Adam Vaughan, a principal at Navigator, but more relevant to this conversation, former Liberal MP, member of that government, of course. So we've understood there have been several people who have said, you know, I'm not running again, so they're leaving cabinet, four of them. Three others we know are leaving cabinet, effectively being demoted there, Lametti, Marco Medicino, among those. What do you make of what you're hearing so far about the fact that so much of the cabinet is really going to take on new portfolios?
So building a cabinet is not easy. don't begrudge the Prime Minister the work here. It's tough because it's not just the cabinet. Cabinet, Yuri said, it's also caucus management, and about 150 MPs up there who all want to be in cabinet.
Yeah.
So it's pretty clear that the Trudeau government right now is resetting around the economic sort of thrust they want to push into a fall agenda in Parliament, focused largely on housing, I'm told, but there are other economic indicators which are challenging. And so he wants to sort of build the A-team around the economic issues, and that requires moving people. And before you move people, you check, am I moving you and you're running again? That's why you saw the sort of the announcements of retirement. And then you take a look at the strong and the weak performers. And then you start to take a look at how that balances out geographically across the regions, linguistically across the languages. Mm-hmm. The Prime Minister is, responsibly taking a long look at how gender sort of influences decisions around the cabinet table. And then you start to look at, and I think this is where some of the speculation is leading, which voting blocks do you need to pay attention to? Yeah. As you head into the next election. And that's both sort of cultural, ethnic voting blocks that you see in some parts of the country. It's also regional sort of representation that drives that agenda, and people in swing ridings. So you got a lot of math to do and a lot of calculations to make, but at the center of it all is an economic reset that the Prime Minister wants to launch in the fall.
And when you talk about an economic reset, we're seeing Anita Anand apparently.
Okay, so what an inventory of junior tetrad management. And I'll say the headline is, this is what the average person is pissed off at. The lot of math you have to do to orchestrate all the different audiences you think you have in the Canadian political thing. So he talked about gender, region, language, and about two other things. He listed off four or five fucking things that you have to manage.
Yeah.
And that's... The public is conscious. Nobody said that in the 60s. They didn't list off all these fucking things. Well, we're not here to improve your life or something. We're here to figure out how our image adapts to all you fucking idiots out there.
Exactly.
And the differences. Yeah.
It's amazing how, yeah.
Let me say this. What did McLuhan say in the 60s? He said, the politician will give up his platforms, the ideologies, and go for the image. The image is bigger than the politician. Well, that's the beginning of the managing of your image. And we just heard Adam, 50 fucking years later, knowingly, because he's part of it, he did it, shows what the politician does. And what's interesting is he has no qualms about saying that, what he just said. I don't know if anybody else would say it like that. I don't know, maybe a little bit. On Tucker Carlson, but he made an incredible inventory there, right?
Right.
Of
yes.
What we had to do. Okay, so what were you going to say?
Just that it's amazing because, and it's well stated and, you could be in a mindset where you're just absolutely like, yes, right on. People don't appreciate all these different calculations you have to do. And it's just like, there's just this completely, or I don't know, maybe he's not oblivious, but there is at least there's a shameless obliviousness or a shameless completely ignoring of the whole idea that like, Maybe you get reelected by doing a good job. You know, like this whole thing where he's like, all the math he has to do to narrow the potential candidates for a cabinet position, he has to narrow it this way, and then narrow it that way, and narrow it this way. He's got six different ways he has to narrow down the field of candidates, and then you can finally, maybe then you can look at the tiny pool of two people you have left and decide which one is better for the job. Yeah. Which one's more competent, you know? Like, that's
old fashioned. Yeah, so listen to this. Adam grew up with McLuhan in his home.
Yeah.
You know, his father, Colin Vaughn, was a content manager at City TV, and that this is an interview on City TV that Adam eventually worked at after CKLN. But the Vaughn family lived on the edge of Wychwood Park. And so McLuhan was a good friend of Colin, so he'd often be visiting his neighbor, Colin, and Adam Vaughn, the kid, knew of McLuhan, experienced him. And so it's really ironic or appropriate that Adam is the most skillful guy to list it, but because he grew up with McLuhan, he doesn't know that it's, if he tried that in America, fucking he'd get assassinated by all these, pissed off Republicans or whatever they are out there who are damn sick of this fucking media manipulation. And because we've gone into social media 2.0 and everybody's in a God position, they are insulted if you're telling them, I'm managing you and who you represent, and I got a bunch of other people, and it requires a lot of math, and this is what the rebellion is. But in Canada, I think they kind of, maybe they're 10 years behind, so they like this management. That sounds cool, you know what I mean? Because it's a different sensibility. It's more actual tribal in Canada. They want the conformity. This is what Friedenberg wrote about Canada. You don't have that in the States. And anyways, it's very revealing what Adam did there.
Yes. Yes, it really is.
And I don't think that's what Greg... I don't think Greg understands that. He should understand it. Figure it out what it is, because that's what you're up against, Greg. You are sick of the fucking management of media and then the ideological hypocrisy within it, because it's like there's where Adam is a little fucking asleep a bit. You don't fucking admit that. You can maybe in Canada, but Greg can't take it anymore, so he's not watching any Canadian TV because there's too much of this hypocrisy. Now, it's not extreme tetra management, which is like managing environments over the whole planet, like McLuhan and Playboy will have a little more radio, a little less TV or something. It's more of a content management, but it's close to tetra management, because in the course of those things he listed, there might be some flips, some obsolescences, you know what I mean? Parts of the tetrad in the consideration of the math. But I think it was more just putting the image out there. We must represent everybody. We must appear to be acknowledging everybody. And that's all they do. And so nothing can get done the last 30 years on any hardware level. Like that's what LaRouche complained about. There's no hardware development. It's all software management. So that's the hypocrisy of our times. And that's what McLuhan had to satirize. So how did he do it? Well, he revealed it. He said, this is what you're doing. But he himself, his quadrophenia, he would not have a point of view. That's outrageous. I remember Gail Zappa saying, any kids that come around and date our kids, they got to have a point of view. See, that's an American bias. Americans, they're individualists in their meme, so you've got to have a point of view. You can't be an airhead. Canada is an airhead culture. Remember, they were known, starting with Lester Pearson, as not opinionated. They got along with everybody, and they became the mediators. So Lester Pearson got a Nobel Prize doing that, and that was Canadian identity. So we're not as opinionated like that. But we accept the tribal management of order. We want order, and we know it's complex. So Adam expressed all the math that goes into this. In Canada, it goes in every culture, but more extreme in North America. But there's a difference between an Adam Vaughn and a some well-known guy who would be in the American media. A George Will, say. He's a conservative. He's very responsible, and, you know, it's got to be balanced and all this stuff.
I hate that guy. That,
what?
George Will, what a piece of shit he is.
he takes it personally. You take tender managers personally. Yeah, he's a shit, but he has a role in the panoply of opinions that Americans think have to be representative.
Well, Canadians can't have an opinion because their opinion has to align with the United States.
That's
so
right.
It's pointless. Let's it's see. Pointless for a Canadian to have an opinion because, you know.
Well, not only that, they're not considered a factor. But the only factor they had for a little while was the Lester Pearson role as a mediator.
Yeah, but he was, but yeah, I mean, that looks, that's all false too. That idea
as the world got hotter, that didn't work anymore. So Canada got sidelined.
That was just stage management for Canadians to make out that he was some great mediator or working.
Well, we're talking about stage management.
Yeah.
And that's
right.
What you're stuck with. You're not going to get past stage management.
Pearson was just working for America. Do you think his name would be on the Toronto airport if he wasn't working for America?
Well, he's working for stage management, not America. The corporations, the Bilderbergers and them, the ones who, you know, have a stake in the global theater, they wanted stability. They didn't want war. They didn't want something that disrupted their business. So, many people since the 60s, consider themselves wise by accepting this corporate management. And this is what Trump upset. So Trump was a manipian, but he was within the tech body, and that's what we're trying to explain in my book and with Cameron. What's the difference between the tech body and Trump, or how much are they melded together? But the forget that point. This thing of management is so a satirical statement by McLuhan is that all men are shepherds now, and the media that they manage are the sheep, and you can only be a shepherd. Who's laughing at that?
Brian.
Yeah. All I can be is a shepherd. And all that McLuhan says, the media is too big for you. There's huge forces that involve people. If you call it conditioning, that you wouldn't, even if you were a wise king, he said, you couldn't do anything but give in to the media management you have to do because the media runs the show now. There's too many media environments that people need to live in to disrupt them. So everybody who's an opinionated person in America looks like an extremist. And so you got the apolitical liberals or what's a liberal? Someone who kind of just tolerates the corporate impersonality and doesn't have any particular strong opinion in the old-fashioned sense. So they're nice shepherds. And you'll see when they go on Johnny Carson or any talk shows, they are very balanced about things. They don't really have an opinion. But if they're closer to real management, where I lay out in Bosnia Ecology Part 2, the four types of media ecology, they will assassinate you. You know what I mean? You will be assassinated because you're disrupting things. The liberal doesn't acknowledge that publicly. They know it has to be done. I mean, that's amazing. When we talk about, when I've talked to people about what we're going to do with Coldplay and all that stuff, you're going to be assassinated, Bob. Now, this is an average, sophisticated person. There's this guy, a friend of Carolyn's, she walks with in the morning. I eventually was forced to talk to him, and I started laying this stuff out, what we're going to do, because Carolyn didn't talk about what we do. And so he didn't really know about it. So I said, okay, he wants to talk to me. Here's what I have to say. So I presented what we're doing in an extreme way. And he said, well, my nephew went to Harvard, and he was an inventor, and we invented a bunch of stuff, a better kind of fuel. So we were taking on the oil industry. And he says, some people showed up to us and said, you can do what you're trying to do, but we own it. And he didn't even know who they were. But he decided that they were some kind of mafia. And so they stopped doing their idea because they saw that they couldn't get past these murderers that were not shy telling him, don't think that you're in charge here. So he said that's how he experienced the inner management of Big Brother in the global theater. And he said, I'm up against the same thing. I said, yeah, that's true. I got 11 bodyguards. So I was able to respond in a way that he didn't know that I'd accept that and have an awareness of it and have to deal with it. So, but he's a liberal guy, a very nice guy. He's a mystic. And, you know, he feeds the cats and all this stuff. Very nice person. But he has this deep cynicism in him because he ran into it. And yeah. It's the acceptance of that that the liberals do. They don't talk about it, but you push them, you find out, well, they know what's behind the scenes, the real management, yeah. Or the murdering part of it. Yes. Have you ever heard
yes.
me well, like
at,
four types?
Even if they don't, or like they know enough about it to have decided that the less they know in detail, the better, because they're
yeah.
kind of fundamental.
Because they know they can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
And if we're successful, we're only successful because we got fucking non-physical helping us. Okay? Not many people have that going for them. And, you know, Ian knows what's going on around us all the time. He can tell me, okay, that person's going to do this to you. You know? So, now look at every president, going back to Roosevelt, had a psychic in the White House. Every
right.
president, they have to do it. They have to get someone who might be reasonably good at that. Because
you'd be negligent if you didn't. You know, you can't just leave that on the table as a possible, you know, the Secret Service or whatever. If they're just trying every way they can to protect the president. Yeah, you got to have Secret Service on the astral plane.
Yeah, so the Nixon's, Gene Dixon advised the Nixon, told Dixon that Trump's going to become significant. That came out later in correspondence between Nixon and Trump. But there was someone else in the Kennedy administration and someone before that in the 50s. Gene Dixon, I think, was a major advisor for several administrations. And then it came out in the Reagan administration, and Nancy had some astrologer that she relied on. So the psychic and the popular culture is, you know, you're a flake if you acknowledge the psychic. And most of the psychic world, it's flakes, but there are actual people who fucking can do stuff. And we may have the best one ever. And that's why we kind of we're still alive.
Right.
So So back to what? How would you satirize that this situation?
Oh, yeah. This becomes very difficult now because you know it's gotten me thinking about. By way of reapproaching the present dilemma again, one thing that's kind of amusing to me reading this book is that. You know, obviously, in a number of ways, in general themes, but also every once in a while in very specific statements, you know, it's very clear that, that you fit the bill as a Menippean satirist, you know, but it's just,
well, I would
just
say that
because,
the whole, hey Brian, on that point,
yeah.
I would have said that even before you said it, that the way we deal with information with Ion and what we do and what we say, within human communication verbally, we are a weird satire. And the extra satire
yes.
is we actually are going to do what we say sounds fanciful. You know? And that's a new kind of satire to fucking
Well, this is the thing. I was gonna try to build up to it as well, but like nothing could be more irritating to the audience than for you to come through on their big claims, whether it's the aliens picking you to be the, you know, the ambassador or contact liaison or whatever, or whether it's you and, you know, Ion and Carolyn and them all like it, coming out with the you know, Coldplay.
Brian, it's stuff that will grow your arms back on the medicine level.
Well, exactly, because imagine that it's like, doesn't it just make sense that, you know, in God's land or something, like, obviously, he wouldn't let someone come and solve these major problems without it also being very funny by being an artistic statement or something.
Yeah.
By having a great background of like, and, you know, maybe the part of the reason why we were able to perform these, you know, kind of modern miracles or miracles of neoscience is because it's also the funniest joke ever, because nothing could be more irritating to the current satire audience than that this particular, you know, barking dog, turns out to have nailed it, have found Big bone.